Can I slurp?
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to OK Radio. I'm Pavel.
I'm Kelly.
And we're here for part two of William Forsyth, a.k.a. Bill Forsyth, podcast, The Cliffhanger, that we left in part one. So we're back. What were we talking about before?
Abe Lincoln. Daniel Day-Lewis.
That was what we were talking about in the break.
Yeah, it switched.
Yeah.
High voice.
We talked about, in part one, we talked about a lot about nutrition, changing lives, all kinds of nuts and seeds.
Clothes.
We talked about architecture.
Color on your mood.
Yeah. Yeah. Exercise. Okay. Yeah. Here's what we talked about. This is where we left off, which is radio dance.
Oh, radio dance.
Yeah. How would you choreograph a dance on radio? Or is it just completely impossible?
Well, I put choreographic instructions. You know, in Paris, those big things where they give you all the information, like, you know, there's traffic on the A4 and avoid that da-da, and the subway number 2 isn't working.
Verbal instructions.
Yeah, I gave instructions, and they were all over the city.
That's nice.
Yeah, it was sweet, eh?
Yeah.
But that's not radio.
No, but that's still, we're getting there because it's textual. Radio.
Do people do that?
Yeah.
But does it only have to be textual? Like that, I think that's the first answer. That's how
do
could
you
choreograph?
Do you want people to dance? Do you want people to dance or the people dancing on the radio?
I want you to choreograph a dance on radio for Kelly right now.
You're very demanding.
Yes, that's my middle name.
Is he always like that?
My middle name.
Pavel D for demand.
Pavel D. Lishka.
Delishka.
Yeah. But see, actually,
well, okay,
the radio is great for a dancer like Kelly because she could actually be a virtuosic dancer on radio.
Wait a minute. People like, we can go like, ooh, well, we'd have to like, there has to be some sort of reaction, right? Whoa, what is she doing there? Wait a minute. She's lifting her leg.
You could do like a color commentary.
Like a football game.
Yeah. That could be one way of, but that would be referring to something else. That would be referring to an actual performance that would be happening rather than a genuine exploration of what a radio dance could be.
I can't watch scary movies.
No?
No, I'm terrible. I'm there because I have to look at people's bodies all the time, figure out what state they're in and, you know, give them feedback. So we're getting there, right? So I was watching Inglourious Basterds. You know the scene where Christoph Waltz starts laughing?
No.
Oh, fuck. It's terrible because you know that it's all going to go very wrong. And it's the most evil scene you've ever seen. But in a very social situation, he just gets hysterical because he knows he's figured someone out. And I realized at that point I couldn't watch the film. So what I do is I turn off the picture and I listen to the film as a radio play.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And it's really great because you hear all the action and the Atmos and all the Foley work.
But you don't cover your ears.
No, I don't cover my ears. I just listen to it at a certain point. I'll just listen to it and see what happens. And then I'll watch it with the sound off.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And maybe then I can put the two together without getting totally stressed out.
But how would you? So
I don't know. I'm saying maybe this is a way towards our dance. You know, because dance is usually a visual thing. So it depends on what an expanding.
But that's a limiting definition of dance.
I mean,
coming from you.
Coming out of my mouth. Is that an expanded definition of dance? I think I've been working on the idea of expanded choreography, you know, through the, but I haven't. I don't think that dance and choreography are the same practice.
Yeah. Okay. So choreography. So you could choreograph.
You could somehow. Well, I don't know. When a radio station plays music, right? Don't people like? That's how I grew up. They used to play musicals, and every afternoon, and I would rush home, and in the kitchen, I would grab onto the refrigerator and all the shelf drawers and stuff like that, and do these giant dances for hours on my own, and I guess. You know, it depends on who receives the info, you know. Someone else sat in their chair sort of, you know, rocking, and I was banging around between all the cabinets.
Could you translate the classical situation of choreographer and dancer into radio and Kelly being your your dancer.
Yeah, why? I mean, great.
Yeah, don't you want to have a dance choreographed for you by Bill Forsyth?
Now, are you saying that there is someone going to see this?
No. It's right. Just the radio. The expanded notion, yeah. That's what I'm
saying. So, wait a minute. Is Kelly on the radio or am I on the radio? I don't know.
You both are on the radio, but she would probably be on the radio. She would probably be the performer. Dance choreographed by Bill Forsyth, performed by Kelly Copper.
Maybe it needs to, maybe like... Okay, if I was blind, I could get a tap dance.
Yeah, so is dance not for blind people?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Tap dancing is great for that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Let me think.
Maybe breath. Maybe something to do with breath. Like you could choreograph.
We have that.
Yeah?
Our rep. We have a whole bunch of pieces that have breath scores.
But do you turn off the lights?
Well, the dancers can figure out where they are by what breathing they're doing. We were just actually doing it the other day, bringing it back. So
I would love to see that.
It's nice. It's really nice, yeah. But you know what you're doing? Just learn the steps. You have to learn the breathing. So I guess breathing but depends on how
you... So do a phrase that's just breathing.
I have to get up and do the movement too, because it's connected. You can't.
But could you remember it or...
There's an on the Synchronous Objects website, I do a sing through of the dance of the table dance that you like.
Yeah,
I do. I don't know if it's synced. They said they finally got it synced. I do a sing through, so you could turn off the picture and just listen to the sing through. So I'm watching a dance. And I know the choreography. I didn't know that I watched certain parts. Mm-hmm. And so we were looking at the, what do they call it, polymodal perception notion, that if you add sound, that's the reason why I can't watch the scary movies, that the action becomes stronger. Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, something like that, I could dance for Kelly. Okay, Kelly, you're gonna make little vocal noises, yeah? Are you ready?
Yeah.
And... And we do this in performance. So I have a bunch of guys doing Foley stuff, and I have these people who are just sort of very funny vocalists, and they do these same sort of thing.
Yeah, by the way, that was Bill moving around and Kelly illustrating with voice what he was doing, her interpretation of that.
That's kind of fun. It's great. I would love to see what other people would do, you know.
I could show you guys. It's really, people are, because they know what they're watching and they know how it works, so they
but again, it's watching. Yeah,
yeah, they watch. It's watching, they just watch.
How do you I still want to push.
You
want
to bypass the eyes entirely.
Yeah, I want to remove the eyes. That's where I discovered. You know, like you, Kelly, you were a little bit self-conscious about sounding stupid.
Of course, yeah.
You know,
and
whereas if you didn't,
like,
you wasn't afraid to sounding stupid, or it's like your work is perceived by the eyes.
And a lot of our pieces you don't need to watch. Put it that way.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they're entirely acoustic, vocal. You know what I mean? There's the visual component and the vocal component.
Yeah, but it's like, let's say at the beginning of radio, they just said, oh, we can mic the plays, real plays on stage, and people can hear it. And they were frustrated, like, well, it's not the right thing.
They had to make
radio plays specifically for radio. Now I wonder about... radio performance, radio dance. Mm. Like you could mic your performances and get something like, oh, I'm imagining what they're doing when they're moving, if I close my eyes or if I just hear it on radio. But I wonder what it could be. I know,
but a lot of the stuff, since we're thinking music anyway,
yeah,
they do work acoustically. So as someone has said to me, oh, this would just great for blind people, you know.
Yeah, I mean Balanchine always thought musically, and if you take it to the next level, it's like you think musically, express it musically or orally, as well.
We
it's cheap too. You don't need space.
Yeah, you know, you don't have to pay for music.
Yeah, it's art for the impoverished new times where we have no funding for the arts.
No royalties.
Yeah,
if we're only using the sound that people make. So actually, that is something to do with it. Also, it's like the way we're using sound has to do with that old paradigm. Apropos Balanchine, the paradigm is that there's a piece of music that is obviously great and you are going to interpret it. So you're an interpreter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you're not a composer, you're an interpreter. And Balanchine being in the classical genre, the greatest of all, yeah. But what do you do if you're not Balanchine? Yeah, I have a musical background. I played instruments, sang for a gazillion years in choruses, and learned how to conduct from my grandpa and all that stuff. So, okay, then if not an interpreter of great works of music, how are we musical? And that's my position there is that dancers are inherently musical. They're just the body is a musical instrument.
Oh yeah,
body is musical. So we went from the idea of adapting ourselves to, or mapping ourselves onto another structure to creating our own musical structures using the same principles of construction, but just deciding how that musicality expressed itself. And the table dance, for example, is only about counterpoint. Yeah, one flat thing is only about counterpoint. Yeah. And if you play, there's a certain section of Beethoven, I think it's the Ninth Symphony. If you play it, I have it synced up on some video. It's as if it had been written for that dance.
Huh. Uh-huh. That you consciously did?
No way. No. It's all in just only focused on its own organization. Yeah, but somehow we came up with exactly to the note, exact same timing structures. It's bizarre. I have to show it to you guys.
Yeah.
It's very strange. Or Stravinsky, Firebird. If you look at the cue section from the top, that it hooks up with the Firebird dance. It's like, what?
Yeah.
Like,
like something bigger at play. Yeah. Some kind of like global mathematics.
Or human timing. Human time.
Yeah.
Body time.
Yeah.
Because instruments are played by, you know, bodies, and they're also body size. You don't have bows that are 4 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
They're in some proportion to.
But I would try to make those just to go along with the idea of really, really pushing past the limitation.
I kind of like that idea. Yeah, actually, yeah.
But it's like sometimes I feel like dance. I have problems with life in general, but dance in particular.
I'm glad you said it. I was gonna say
with just functionality, or I struggle with functionality of what I do or what we do as artists. And like I said, like when I see an Egon by Balanchine or One Flat Thing by you, I know intuitively what it's for, but in general I have a hard time going along with the accepted opinion of what it is.
Yeah.
You don't have a distaste for it.
No, I don't have a distaste. I love it more than anybody. I mean, I've said so many times I hate theater, but I love it. I love it more than anybody
anyone
out
else.
There.
Yeah.
I love dance more than anyone else.
Mm-hmm. I love
painting. Yeah. I love art. I want to be constantly surrounded by it everywhere I go. No problem for me. Yet I feel the responsibility and obligation to constantly question my own like of it, so that I know that I can somehow figure out how I can function in this world and how my work and what I love to do, that it's justified and that it's not a selfish endeavor, that I'm doing something that's also open, which comes back to the audience and what their function in that in my world is. So it's not I'm expressing myself here. I need to enjoy the fruits of my my personality or my trauma, childhood trauma.
Well, anything you put out there has to work on so many different levels. It's got to work for the person who walks into the theater for the very first time. Yeah. And you're also having a dialogue with all your professional colleagues about the state of the art. You know what I mean? And you have your own criteria, what's important for you. Oh, we've done that. We can't do that again.
And then you have your people that know your history like for 30 years.
Yeah.
And that's a deeper, different kind of.
Yeah.
And that's why I want to force you or foresight you into making into making a dance for radio. Because the way I've sometimes have defined dance for myself is that it's confrontation with our physical limitations. It's almost like a desire to take flight or desire to overcome or do things that we were not meant to do physically. And that's how it's like technology. We want to fly into space. We build a rocket. We want to fly, so we dance, or we somehow, in some dances, you know, leaps and in ballet, and there is a desire to take flight. There is a desire to get off the ground, or
there has
burr.
Been.
Yeah,
there has been. I want to say that's not you know, first thing in everyone's mind these days.
Probably,
You know, I did those trees in Holland. That's a really slow choreography.
Yeah.
It's a really slow choreography for plants. So I think that maybe radio is not my thing.
Yeah, it's fine.
Apropos my flower and, you know, garden moment, is that made sense for me. Is that, okay, how can I find a medium that's neither, you know, human nor theatrical, whatever? And could I apply the principles? And people might not perceive it as choreographic, but I do. I understand that it's something that's going to outlive me too. It's going to continue, you know.
What if it's like this even? Can you say that something is dance and for it to be dance? Can you say, let's be quiet for 10 seconds and then that was a dance by Bill Forsyth.
Pavel, that was choreographic. Yeah, and whether you want to position in the domain of dance is I guess a question of your prerogative, like John Cage with his piece for 4 minutes.
Yeah, and we just did it 10 seconds.
Yeah, and we
workshop, 10-second workshop.
We're going to have to pay royalties because we were quoting.
Yeah.
And I think that's the interesting moment. Just, you know, is it just because I say so?
Yeah.
You know, but you did give an instruction. And I think that's more the choreographic element. I don't know if it was dancerly. Well, on one hand, we had to, did we hold our breath or did we relax and be quiet? What was, and we all noticed that there was like a tension and a suspension in the moment. I didn't actually count. I was hoping you were counting. And,
yeah.
But something definitely happened to us physically. And I believe that choreography, you know, instigates those kind of things, whether it's up for someone else to decide if it was dancerly. But I, as a choreographer, I would say, well, that's sort of fundamental. That's like one of the basic building blocks of the whole enterprise is to say, okay, this period of time, in this period of time, the body, you're going to ask your body by whatever means to participate in the broadcasting of silence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also the silence may have caused actual movement in the audience. Whereas because if you have a virtuosic dance going on stage, the audience is enraptured and mesmerized by it and not moving. And then the moment it starts to bore them or not be interesting, they start shifting in the...
Oh, yeah.
Right? Actually, so it's like, do you have the less interesting choreography you have on stage, the more they're dancing there is going on in the audience.
We have one piece called Angelo Scuro and this amazing performer I have named Fabrice Mosley. He goes out and does in like super like 8 times the speed, the bored audience member. You know how he's like, when you fast forward the video and you see the audience's heads go side to side? He does that. He does this like the super time lapse version of the audience in a 12-hour piece.
Nice.
Checking his watch, crossing his legs. You know, they're all very fast and kind of jittery. Yeah. I mean, people go to dances for different reasons. People go to dances for different reasons. I mean, people go to ballet for. I think we mentioned this before. For confirmation of certain values or knowledge or experience, you know, it depends on their worldview, what they want from art. Maybe you want to go see Agam, but you don't want to go see Giselle. Mm-hmm. You know, it could be, why not?
Yeah.
You know?
And I guess dancers like musicians, which ties dance to music again, is they're in it's especially in its conventional understanding, there are people who are special. There is a talent almost, or there is a skill that, that dancers have and that people go to see a display of skill and training from early childhood that...
I'm gonna question that.
Of course, I question that.
Yeah, I think that it's more of an ontological question. It's a way of life. It's just a way of being with yourself, your body. You have obviously have to think about your body in a particular way, maybe like a athlete on some level.
Yeah, which brings me back to eating right and taking care of his, you know, all of those things. That's like, how do you live like how do you live like a dancer?
You know, well, I mean, eating right also gives me an idea of myself. Like, I wake up in the morning, I know how I am.
Yeah.
I don't have a hangover. I don't have, you know, yeah. I'm not feeling crap. I know if I'm getting sick, which is not too often, thank God, knock on wood. But I know how I am, and I have that sort of baseline. And I then if I have a lot of stuff coming at me at work, you know, people, all different needs and agendas, and I can sort of, how do you say, orient myself towards that base self that I know is not disturbed by something I've done.
Physically?
Right? Yeah.
You create a physical relationship to the world.
Yeah, exactly. I know who I am in that respect. I know if I feel foggy, I'll go like, oh, why? You know?
It's grounded.
Yeah, I have a sense of my unclouded self.
So it's a physical, it's a purely, but is it a purely physical, materialistic?
Dreams can fuck you up. Dreams can fuck easily, I find. You have a disturbing night in dreams. Suddenly you walk into the day and you're going like, what's going on? You know, like that. But then you know it because you know how you normally feel. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
There's a norm. And I think that I'm really grateful for every molecule of consciousness I can muster. You know, it's so hard to keep straight. You know, there's so
which brings me back to what I asked you before, which is the spiritual practice. If you have, in addition to physical practice, or if it's the same thing for you.
Yeah, I did, I have practice Tonglen.
What is that?
That's a form of meditation. It's a breathing exercise. And I grew up as a Christian Scientist.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, you and Jack Smith as well.
Jack Smith, Peter Sellers, the director.
Quite
a lot of people. Yeah. And it's a very interesting environment as a kid because it brings a lot of things into question that are taken for granted in this sort of mechanistic model of the world. You don't have that quite the same. Although there is a little cause and effect in the kind of morality department there. Like with some religions.
With most religions.
Yeah. And but I like the one of the statements from Mary Baker Eddy, which is, there is no life, truth, substance, nor intelligence in matter. All is infinite mind and its infinite manifestations. So I had that experience, and I had recently, I was at CERN at the Atom Collider, giant thing there, a Hadron Collider. And for some reason I had an audience for about an hour and a half with the world's antimatter specialist. And he said, well, basically this is all just a kind of fiction. He said, it really isn't here. And I said, oh, that reminds me of, you know, this Mary Baker or anything. And he was like, that's basically it. Wow. He said, there's just something that makes us, you know, feel that it is. I'm obviously paraphrasing pathetically right now. I couldn't possibly begin to express what he expressed to me, but it was like, yeah, okay. It didn't seem that strange to me, just having been inculcated with this.
Because your parents were Christian Scientists?
Yeah, yeah.
And did you reject it completely, or you still retain a lot of it?
No, I'm sort of this way with a lot of things. I don't discriminate. I realize if someone needs that as a belief system to make their life work, I was like, believe it.
Yeah.
Go right ahead. Who am I to tell you how to, you know?
Yeah, I got the book, Mary Baker Eddy, and I never read it. I got it because I know Jack Smith was a Christian Scientist, and I wanted to. Yeah. I always try to emulate, as you can probably tell. I try to find out from the people
something's
that I love and
changed.
Respect.
We're going to get you on that field tomorrow morning.
I own it. Yeah, no.
It's beautiful.
Yeah,
you're going to love
me.
It.
Yeah.
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 So, so that was an interesting environment to be in, and it did affect my worldview. Whereas you felt that things were apropos willpower. Well, I think as a kid you could confuse healing it as it is proposed in that practice with willpower.
Yeah.
So that said, I did not think though it would be impossible. I entertained the idea that such a thing would be possible. You know, so why not? There's a great quote I have from Rilke saying that we've lost touch with a lot of things that make, you know, the world more interesting, and that we don't even the capacity we have to get in touch with certain things has withered, you know, and I wonder about that.
I definitely agree with that. I mean, that's all the little distractions that I go through every day, I feel and I know are keeping me from getting in touch with all those other things that I have lost the capacity to even perceive. Mm-hmm. And I know there's, on one hand, it makes me excited because I understand that there is so much out there still to be discovered. That the world that I am looking, my eyes are open now, my ears are open now, my nose is open to smell, and I know I'm only perceiving about 5% of everything that's there.
Right.
And I'm pumped because I know that I at least have the desire to perceive as I get older, perceive more and more and more, and that it's still there rather than getting to a midlife crisis where, oh, I've seen it all, I know it, I know what's there, and I'm just going to kind of survive the rest of the time.
You'd be surprised how much we can shut down. I went to a kinesiologist, great guy in Paris, because I was having shoulder trouble. And we figured out finally that I had stopped smelling.
Oh, yeah? You'd said you smelled flowers?
Well, no, because my wife had died. Oh. And I took care of her until through that whole period. And I actually...
What did she die?
Cancer. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I had actually closed down my nose. Mm-hmm. And then I suddenly was like, and I rediscovered it in the fall. That's why the fall always, I always sort of go through this, great, you know, smell. The other day I was smelling the fall again. So it always signifies for me now this kind of like, oh, right, restart. Strangely, not spring.
Yeah.
So, and who knew that my shoulder problem had to do with the fact that I had stopped smelling? Alvin Noah, do you know Alvin Noah, the philosopher? Okay, he's about embodied consciousness. And he gave a talk on the radio. Yeah. He gave a philosopher's concert.
A dance on the radio. Yeah. He gave a dance.
He probably could, knowing Alva. At a conference for ophthalmologists, and it turns out that they suspect that a lot of seeing problems are related to posture.
Wow.
Yeah. And there was a story about a guy who had his eyes were divergent, and they operated them on, and he couldn't get the two images to merge. And then it, what was the deal? Something happened, and he changed how he was standing or thinking, and all of a sudden, the doctor said it's psychological because we've corrected your eyes. And so finally, there was something to do with his posture change, and the images finally merged. And that said, the discussion apparently is now that many ailments related to vision could maybe be fixed by addressing certain postural.
Yeah, that maybe it explains, Kelly, why you need glasses, because your posture has always been problematic.
She just likes the way they look.
Yeah.
No, I mean, like, the older I get, the more I realize, like, it's one thing that knocks out another thing. Mm-hmm. And, I remember going to, last time we were here in Frankfurt, somebody hooked me up with whoever you use for a kinesthesiologist here, mm-hmm. because I was having, like, a lot of back pain, and they... Spent a lot of time.
Sven, yeah.
Yeah, I was getting up really literally at like 5:30 in the morning because they were squeezing me in before everybody else because they had no available slots. And I was in so much pain that I was gladly waking
willing
up.
To do it.
Yeah, taking the taxi, paying whatever I had to, you know, just to get to feel better. But I kept thinking, like, you know, you're working the wrong thing. Like, you're working like this shoulder area. And it's my lower back, but it was really like it was tied up in a different place entirely.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I had just accepted the fact that like I have like this scoliosis and that it's just going to get worse.
And my wife has it also. Yeah.
Yeah. And he was like, you shouldn't let yourself, you know, in this heavy German. I was like, you shouldn't do this to yourself. And I was like, well, but I'm not doing anything to myself. This is just the way I am. And I think after that is when I started to put together, like, you know, I just never grew up with any kind of like physical
practice.
No. Like my parents did not do sports. They did not go to the gym. We ate like canned pears with Velveeta cheese was considered like the fruit of the, you know, and like, so really my adulthood has been kind of like getting in touch with like a different kind of way of thinking about these things. And I feel a lot healthier and happier and better as an adult than I think I did as a kid or a teenager. And you just realize that all that stuff is so connected. Mm. Which is like a new thing for me.
If I ate canned peaches and Velveeta, I might have trouble finding that that fundamental me.
Because when you were a kid, you didn't eat garbage?
My mom was a really good... We ate garbage too. We were Americans, you know. Of course, we ate Velveeta every now and then. A lot of stuff, you know. It was normal back then.
So you're
in the 50s, you know. Sure.
But your new habits of eating... You were not working against a wall of resistance from your natural tastes. Like, I'm working against a lot of fried cheese. I'm working against potatoes. Against so much sausages,
cheese
fat,
is hard.
Pork. You know.
Yeah.
And I'm married to someone who's of Scandinavian Norwegian, you know, background, and you know, cheese is a really important part of life if you're from Minnesota.
Yeah.
You know. So, weaning oneself from cheese is really a challenge. And I've gotten to the point that I eat something called Handkäse in German, which is...
I heard about that.
Yeah, it has massive amounts of protein. It's basically whey that's been pure whey that's been turned into cheese. And it has, 1 gram of fat.
Wow.
So I can eat all that I want, but it's stinky. It smells like stinky feet, but you just—it's like some of those Bergkäse, the mountain cheeses from Switzerland. They're really stinky, but they're delicious.
Yeah,
that sounds great. No, somebody was talking about like, have you tried the hand cheese?
Oh, it's good. It's good.
That sounds gross, but
no. As opposed to the head cheese.
Yeah, no, that's for sure here too.
Cheese is just it's like the siren in the supermarket.
Yeah. Calling you.
Yeah,
like Bill.
You know you want it.
Yeah, it has a deep voice.
yeah, whatever.
The cheese has a deep voice.
Sultry.
Yeah, sultry deep male though.
You're gay
when it comes to cheese.
No, actually, it has a female voice.
Oh, it does.
Yeah, it's sultry. It's it's not, you know, it's me doing her.
Yeah. And that meditation, what does that entail? What do you do? What kind of, what is it called again?
Tonglen. It's basically, if you're experiencing discomfort, this is really bad. People are going to be furious if I explain it this way. But rather than try to put things away, you try to actually increase your relationship to it by breathing it in and imagining everyone else might be feeling the same kind of, let's say, for example, self-loathing. Yeah. And you try to increase it with each breath. And then at the same time, as you exhale, you try to give out what would be essentially the opposite, what you would wish for those people to have in the world.
And do you send energies through your body, kind of, or you don't mix it up? And
in a kind of
a Taoist, I know that I practiced one time Taoist, like you inhale and all that, you kind of send a ball of energy down your spine and then you...
It's not so pictorial like that. In the form of meditation, that's one form. You drop the storyline. If you're having an emotion, you drop the storyline immediately. Also, apropos sleeping, that help. But you focus on the physical sensation of an emotion, because emotions are physical; they're not mental.
Yeah.
So you examine that, and you examine it in this case by trying to actually increase it. Instead of saying, oh, please, okay, now I see what you are physically, please go away, you try to see if you can't amplify it so you really know it. That's the interesting part. And I guess if I would say there's a practice, it would be not shying away from those things, actually seeing them as the important things that need attention. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Knowing yourself.
Yeah, my wife's a conflict mediator. So that's also been very, very interesting.
God, that's such a great skill to have for the wife.
Wow.
I don't have that.
Incredible.
Yeah.
You want one.
Yeah. Kelly, learn that.
Yeah. You should get one, like, you know, so people have au pairs and things like that. You know,
Managers, production managers, conflict resolution.
No joke. Yeah. It's changed the culture in our company. Mm-hmm. It's changed the culture in my family. Everything. It's
so when there is conflict in the company during rehearsal, does she step in to mediate?
No, we all know in the meantime how to deal with it, you know, and what you have to listen to, and it's the way you make statements. You know how you don't shut other people down in a certain way. There's ways you can interact with people so that they feel they've been heard.
Yeah.
And for example, a very interesting skill is acknowledgement without agreement.
Yeah.
That's a very tricky one. Another one is reflective listening, similar. And my favorite is attribution error.
What's that?
Which is you're an asshole, but I've had my reasons for acting a certain way. So you don't imagine other people in situations that might cause the behavior they're exhibiting. So you end up now, I guess it's almost like precursor to compassion. You know, it's going like, maybe there's something I don't know about that person. So not making assumptions about the reasons for other people's behavior.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Does that mean you talk a lot in rehearsals? When you just, you want to validate, you want to create space for those people to voice their emotions or...
That's not it. That's not the point. The point is that actually trying to figure out what's trying to be said. It's not what people are saying. It's what... There's something else sometimes.
Yeah.
People, you know, everyone's, as my wife says, frayed bad. It's F-R-A-I-D. It comes from who's the guy that did Jeff and Ahmed, that cartoon?
I don't know. Denmark?
Was it Matt Groening? I'm not sure, but there's a little rabbit, and the rabbit was frayed bad. And I think, you know, there's with performers, if you're trying to say, you know, I think you should do it maybe that way, and da-da-da, people are constantly going like, does this look like shit? Am I producing crap? You know, and so this whole process of feedback and all these things, it's tricky. It's hard to be a performer. Fuck yeah.
Yeah, but also to give that feed, to be the choreographer or the director.
Right.
Because you're giving feedback to 10 people, and it's like a lot to give out all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how do you find a balance for yourself? What's fair? You know, what's
and when do you get the feedback? When do you get feedback?
Just critique.
Only critique.
Yeah, I mean, Kelly and I are lucky that there's two of us because I've stopped talking to the company as a group. I talk to them individually, and now Kelly only does the notes to the group before performance.
Okay.
Because it was very exhausting, and I need a break from it. I'm sure I'll come back to it, but I very much prefer to talk to people individually. Over time, rather than give a pep talk before a performance.
It's very difficult to say to everyone what applies to someone.
Yeah.
That's a big mistake.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, because everyone goes, is it me? You know, and I think people, because maybe if someone who doesn't, it's difficult to discuss things with, they might take it the wrong way. I mean, you know, it's people. You're dealing with people, not objects. You're not sort of, you know, moving furniture around the room. You're dealing with people's needs, their desires.
How many people do you have? How many performers do you have?
I actually don't know.
You don't know? Were you afraid that I was going to ask that question?
I think it goes up and down. I know it goes up and down. I never really know who's going to be there all the time. I don't actually... I've never counted.
You don't count.
I don't count, yeah. You know.
There's 15 of us. I counted yesterday. I always thought it was 16, but...
Is it with performers?
All of us right now can be as 15 people.
I think with me it's like 18, yeah. But then I have a lot of infrastructure.
Yeah.
So that's what the government subvention helps.
Yeah.
Is that you actually have infrastructure, which is awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh man.
Yeah. Are you happier now than you were when you worked with Ballet Frankfurt?
Oh. No, it's sort of been a continuum.
Uh-huh.
I think it wasn't a break. It was just this. I couldn't, for example, work. I work with a different kind of performer. I don't need to work on point anymore,
uh-huh.
and because I'm not doing that kind of rep, because way too expensive. Point shoes are like $70 a pop.
Yeah, I was so surprised, and they wear out like instantly.
Yeah,
right.
Like in a matter of hours.
Yeah.
Yeah, it depending, and so it's like prohibitively expensive. And so that, you know, people said, why did you change your style? I was like, I couldn't afford my style, quite frankly, you know. So, and also as certain performers, you know, matured, so, that, you know, you start working with them when they're 20 and all of a sudden they're 50, you know.
Yeah.
So that said, generations have changed and different kind of dancers has moved in. And so you make work for the people you have, you know. And so it's, yeah, it's totally interesting.
Do you still make work for yourself? Like you?
No.
No?
No. No, I'm out in the field.
Yeah.
You know, I'm having a good time there. It's like I don't need to perform for anyone. I just enjoy dancing.
Yeah.
I go out in the field. And,
in the park and on the treadmill.
Dance-a-roo. Yeah. I like that.
But do you think you'll, like when you're 80, you'll make a piece for yourself like Cunningham did?
No, we're very, very different people.
Uh-huh.
I just don't have the urge or the need to be on stage.
Yeah.
Yeah. Every now and then, I mean, I enjoy performing, for example, as the conductor of the piece and being live with everyone, but I don't need to be, you know, showing my face.
Scene, yeah.
Yeah. I prefer to actually just sneak out of the theater would be my favorite version.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With your hat on, like when we were in Avignon and you were showing the installation, I forget the name.
Was I sneaking out of the theater?
Yeah. You had your Nature Theater of Oklahoma t-shirt on and you had a baseball cap and sunglasses and you were kind of sneaking around the room.
That's what the beard does now.
It was fun to, I almost kind of played your bodyguard where I was, guiding people into different parts so that they couldn't really recognize you, and you were listening in on their conversations about the piece.
Yeah.
But when we were in Avignon, we last time a year ago we talked about selling stuff.
Oh yeah. I've been discussing that.
Has that?
Yeah. Well, we got our contract renewed, so we didn't have to sell everything.
Uh huh.
But
you don't think that commerce is, because I don't know, this has come up a lot lately, like commerce and art, should they be separate things, or is it fine for them to commingle?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that you know, these, the emergence of a market is a big phenomena, you know, and the shrinking of a market is also a phenomena. So I think it has a lot to do with dominant technologies. Theater used to be, you know, theaters, opera houses were the new, display model for information, certain kinds of information, where things could be communicated in a very unique new way. I was in Rouen looking at the cathedral there and these amazing stained glass windows, and I was like, oh my god, it's the TV of 1212, you know? It's incredible, like Technicolor versions of, you know, Joseph and the whatever. And so it was, I was going like, right, that was the dominant technology. And then there's a great essay by Victor Hugo, which is named This Will Kill That, and he tries to propose that cathedral architecture was killed by the printing press. Where you didn't have to go to this place and get this certain information. And theater right now, what is the purpose? We're asking ourselves, why are we doing this? Just because, you know, we like it and we believe in it. I don't know if you have this issue. People have come and said, we really want to make a film of your piece. I'm going like,
Not really.
It'll happen. And I'm going like, well, it's not for that media. It's created for a particular medium.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about, the radio days.
Yeah.
Can you make for this particular medium?
Well, any more than you want.
I didn't want you to do an interpretation of something that was made for another medium.
Yeah, okay, so we get to that discussion. Yeah. I mean, you know, we can do, I'm sure there, I did a dance for film, you know, once I did a solo, you know. Mm-hmm. But I don't personally want to take my pieces and put them on film. I've tried to avoid that. Because they're designed for a particular medium, which is live theater, and it has we all know right here in this room, so many factors at play: the quality of sound in the room, and just I don't know.
I mean, some people think that we're romanticizing it, but it's actually true. You know, people say like, "Oh, you can never get the flavor of the show from watching a video." And I said, no, I can get it. I can watch this on video. And I'll
I'm
get
used
it.
To like, watching it on video.
Fuck you. But it's not. Yeah, and it's not a romantic notion. We're not talking about like, it's the special, the precious live element. You know, it's not the precious live element. It's just it's material.
Didn't you bust your ass to get the sound right? Just so you know the balance this way and that and that and that. So it's a 3D experience.
Yeah.
You know what
and
I mean?
The
it's,
audience the right distance from the stage.
Oh my God!
And the actors the right distance from the audience.
It's so they don't people don't realize it's all carefully calibrated to provide a certain kind of experience.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you can do you know Michael Flatley, Feet of Flames on. On film, it probably doesn't lose it.
Or radio.
Or radio, indeed. And doesn't lose it, you know, very much, except the scale of the spectacle. Even then, I guess, you'd lose sort of the bombast part, which is maybe very important in that.
But
show.
You could blow it up to, you know, like 70 million feet high and, you know, get some of that back in a different way. But
Yeah. But I'm, you know, I have one little sound coming from the back, and people don't realize that I've, you know, introduced that Atmo, like a film Atmo, you know, into the room to change everyone's idea about where they are. And for example, a lot of these pieces with sound scores, you don't realize, but are like one flat thing. The whole thing's being mic'd. And in order to create this rhythm in the audience, I'll increase it. And so it makes everything actually look closer, although it isn't.
Yeah.
Or your experience of being in the event is suddenly you hear, you know, flesh slapping against flesh or whatever.
Tables being dragged.
Yeah, whatever, yeah. Or the breathing. And you assume that you're deeper into the event. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like that. So there's all kinds of little things to make this you part of the event, to entrain you, to sync you up with this.
But what if...
Good.
But what about the ways in which like a film would open up the work to a different audience or, you know, like I've just been thinking a lot about sometimes how insular the theater or dance crowd is and how do you maybe take yourself out of that kind of venue situation?
Well, make work for that medium.
Mm-hmm.
You know, be a choreographer who makes a work for film. And certainly Anna Teresa and Thierry Demay have done some really, really beautiful things, you know. And she managed to adapt her dance. There's certainly instances where I think it's almost more interesting on film. When she, you know, is it Fasen where she's working in the sand? You see her from above and she's working these incredible patterns. And I was like, I'm so glad that film exists. You know, I'm really happy.
Yeah.
I know. I love the Pina film. I like watching those dance. You go, God, Pina's such a great choreographer. Not just the theater stuff, but actually, you know, the movements themselves are spectacular.
Yeah.
And so it's a great chance to sort of see these things. But it's Wim's adaptation for film. Mm-hmm. It really is. Yeah. And she's not trying to produce the work itself again.
It's not a record.
No, it's not. Yeah. And it's not a substitute for the piece.
Yeah.
It's a film event.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I did the work I wanted to do on film in One Flat Thing.
Yeah.
And also the solo.
Yeah, it was very satisfying to watch. Yeah. And I knew I wasn't watching the live show, but I knew I was watching something completely different.
Yeah.
Yeah, but for people like, you know, it took us years to be able to like afford a vacation to go to Europe and see some of the stuff that we wanted to see and to have these things. I mean, and in a way, this has been sort of the some of the momentum behind doing this OK Radio mm-hmm. is, you know, how do you get this information out there in the world? And it doesn't matter if people have money for a plane ticket. It doesn't matter if they can get here or there or anywhere. You know, it can go anywhere and it's totally free.
Yeah, you don't have to sit in the, you don't have to get to the Muzan term and sit in this room.
Which is a great room.
You don't get to say anything.
but you spend time with us. It's not a time medium.
But it's not the shows, but that there's something that's being shared differently.
Yeah. It's also a whole different atmosphere than doing radio. I did a radio interview the other day in Australia and this guy would sort of ask me a question and then answer it. But it like, and then I'd go like, okay.
Yep.
Like, that was okay. Yes. That was okay radio. Yeah. Theater. Yeah. And I was like, no. And then,
And then they're crushed when you say no.
Just like, but then completely turned it around. It was very interesting. It was,
this is a place of discovery. You create a room like this in a hotel room or in the apartment somewhere else, and you hope that you come out of this richer or more alive or something happens.
Friendship
developed, absolutely.
Friendship. Yeah.
And when you tour like this, that you need this kind of complicated like 4-microphone setup for friendship to
happen.
Otherwise,
you wouldn't have come. Yeah, you wouldn't have come here. To just be friends with us.
I would have come for coffee.
Yeah.
But now that you know.
Yeah. I would still hook up the mics and that's.
No, I would have come to performance and we would have been like,
we'd have
hi,
a little chat.
Yeah.
We'd have a little chat that would have no consequences.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's consequences. Exciting. I mean, do you, do movements have consequences or do you have to resort to language to create consequences, or what's the
what are you looking for with consequences?
In terms of the audience again, because you can say fuck you, or you can say, my mother sucks dick.
It's context,
and there
is
consequence.
It's context.
But you can move any which way, and it doesn't have the same consequences.
Yeah,
the dumbest language.
I mean, apropos your mother sucks dick is we did what's it called? You know, the in comedy where you try to tell the worst, most vulgar, horrific joke possible.
Yeah.
Not the ambassadors, the...
Yeah, I know what it is. It starts
aristocrat.
With...
Aristocrats. Thank you. And in the second act of Eidos Telos, one of the characters, we're supposed to be the underworld, because we're... He does this imitation of a junkie I met once in Frankfurt. It was like, oh man, you gotta really help me. I need to get to therapy. And I was like, oh, and you got a lot of tracks in your arms. Fuck you, like that. And so Tony plays this guy. It goes, I'm fucking dead. I'm gonna cut your head off and fuck you in the neck hole and like that. And so it just goes through this list of just really, really awful shit. And but it's set up by the situation. It's horrific and just inestimably rude. You can't possibly understand how you're going to get away with this in that kind of context, big opera house, bam, something like this. And yet the context suddenly makes it funny.
Yeah.
In New York, everyone laughed. The worse it got, the more people laughed. So I guess if you...
But that's language. What about movement? Can that have consequences that are similar or on the same level of...
A context, again, it depends how you set it up. I've said before, like each scene is the gateway to the next. I say to the people, so-and-so is coming after you in this other scene. I say to the people I work with, I say, okay, Pavel Kelly's coming on after you. Understand that that your energy in this scene or whatever you're doing sets her up, whether you're taking it down or taking it up. It's you are the frame for the next person. They're seeing you in relationship,
Yeah. So I just wonder how you can, what kind of movement or choreographic statement could I make that would have the same consequences as a piece of language which potentially has, which is clear, more, it's just, there's an articulation in language that is difficult to describe or that have impact, or I don't.
We have the question: would that even be desirable?
Exactly.
Why do we think that is desirable?
Yeah.
Why do we think that clarity is like, you know?
Yeah. No, not really. Clarity is close to godliness. Yeah, but that's what I was talking about before. Is like I want to break things rather than make them whole. But in terms of just value, when I talk about what is the value of what I do, or what is the function of what I do, and maybe it itself doesn't have to have a value, it doesn't have to have a function, as long as it has consequences.
Well, I mean, consequence, I guess, has to do with who's receiving it.
Yeah.
I mean,
gets back to the audience.
You watch it every night. Yeah. Like there's some things people go to me, oh, that was da da da, and I was, you know, I had this big moment, whatever, and I'm going, great, you know, and they go like, no, aren't you like, you know, I'm like, well. I watch it every night. I'm watching it like a plumber. I'm looking for leaks.
Yeah.
You know, I really am.
Yeah.
You know?
But it has no consequences to you.
Sometimes it can get to me.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, if the performance is sublime, you know, then maybe.
But you're watching like a plumber.
Yeah. You're watching like plumbers, aren't you? Yeah, of course.
That's a great way to say it, actually. Yeah.
We are watching it like plumbers.
Only interested in the leaks, you know?
Yeah.
Which is actually kind of a bummy way to do it, you know, but that
I'm always happy when I you know, like when something
happens, when you know how to fix it too.
Yeah. You know how to fix it.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you are happy when we know how to fix it. Yeah,
it's got some in the toolbox.
Yeah. When you know that you realize that I'm a good plumber. I have been doing it. I know how to fix it.
But Kelly, aren't you relieved sometimes if you there's a show and it was great. Nothing to say.
I was like, every now and then something new happens.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, or like, possibility, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something different to say.
Something that you hadn't seen before. Yeah. That's always like the best.
Yeah, when you see a show 60 times, the same show, you know, it's hard to get pumped other than being a plumber.
Yeah.
But then it does happen that there's something mysterious and surprising happens. And I always look for surprises. But you can do that maybe more easily because you do use more improvisation. There's more structure that allows for that.
Well, there's more things that can actually be variables. There's more variables at play, really. And so I have to find the language to communicate, A, what I saw, so that the performer understands how I perceived it.
Yeah.
We have to talk about where they were at that point, you know, if they can remember, you know. And find a way to discuss this on a level that is not about so much them, but what is our project? Mm-hmm. And often I end up saying, like, what part of the conversation, the big conversation, are we having? Are you talking when you're out there to all the people who've come to say or to have a discussion about dance in their minds? You know, you're colleagues or how do you explain your presence, like why you and not someone else up there?
I don't know.
Yeah, it gets esoteric really quickly. And then sometimes and sometimes I have trouble actually, I think, not putting it on that performer, like them, like you said, just attaching it too firmly to themselves,
to a bigger subject,
but to a bigger conversation that we're having. Mm-hmm. But then it's also hard for that conversation then not to be super esoteric and for everybody to be on the same page. The more people you have,
and sometimes you just want to do a simple correction. You mean just do that slower. Less of those, maybe.
Good. So the thing I take away the most from this conversation is your remark about friendship, you know, because I feel like that's something that happens here when we do this conversation. That ultimately that's really what happens, and I feel like I know you better, and I feel like I know myself better. It's a mutual. It's not an interview like we always say. It's not an interview. It's a conversation, and it's something that I've learned a lot about myself, and I want to promise myself, not even just you, that I will try to give it a shot, give the nuts and seeds and give the sleeping techniques and giving the exercise regimen a serious shot once we're back in New York. Because we're still going to eat some sausages.
Yeah, because here. Still the most available source of food around here is the shop with the head cheese and the smoked meats.
So I want to thank you, Bill, for hanging out with us.
Thank you all. It was awesome.
And we'd love to do it again at some point down the line, just to see if we have made any change or if I'm still in the same.
We're going to put you on the treadmill.
Yeah.
With the earphones.
Yeah, and the attention microphone to a treadmill. Okay. Thanks so much, y'all. Bill.
It's great being here.
Yep.
You've been listening to OK Radio, a production of Nature Theater of Oklahoma, made in cooperation with the Queens Ministry of Culture. This was part two of our podcast with William Forsythe. Join us next time for a thrilling conversation with renowned theater scientist Nicholas Muller-Scholl. For further information about the program, you can visit us on the web at okradio.org, or you can also contact us about the show at okradio@oktheater.org. We hope you subscribe to OK Radio on iTunes, and please remember to share with your friends. Thank you for listening.